Welcome to the Scalable Real Estate Investing Podcast, where we discuss the most scalable strategies, tools, and approaches to successfully invest in real estate. Learn how to make the most impact of your time, automate your real estate investing business, find off-market deals with minimum time invested, and leverage your capital to create as many income streams as possible so that you can achieve true financial independence. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mason Clement. Hi, Scalable Investors. Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to tell you about a group that I'm a part of called Hivemind. If you're serious about taking the next step in your real estate investing career, then this is definitely a group that you need to join. Some of our members are making $90,000 or more per month and as much as $300,000 on just one deal. And at the same time, you don't have to spend thousands of dollars like you typically would joining other mastermind groups. This is only $99 per month. And when you join, you'll gain access to a robust integrated CRM software that allows you to track your leads, run automated triggers, and ultimately scale your marketing efforts. So the difference here is that you're not left high and dry, but gain access to a support network that allows you to use that tool and learn from other more experienced real estate investors. So to learn more, go to scalablerei.com/hivemind. That's HIVEMIND. Thanks a lot. Let's get into the episode. Hi, Scalable Investors. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Scalable Real Estate Investing. I'm your host, Mason Clement. And today we have with us Ken Van Lu. Is that how you say your last name? Van Lu. Okay. Great. Hope I didn't butcher it. So Ken is a major heavyweight. He's been involved in over $1.3 billion in capital investments in Manhattan and other places in New York. So really excited to have him on. Also best-selling author, doing tons of things. So I just can't do you any justice if I steal your thunder. So why don't we get into things, Ken? What's going on?
Absolutely. How are you doing today? Just another extraordinary day, you know, in the metropolitan area here.
Oh yeah, definitely. So you're not in New York. I think before we recorded, you said you're in Jersey.
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey. I'm about 20 miles outside the Holland Tunnel. I'm close to Newark Airport, but you know, the city's been in somewhere I go pretty much every day of my life. So it's been fun.
Okay. Yeah. When I lived there, I always found myself on the, got an emergency call here.
I'm sorry.
No problem. When I lived there, I've always found myself on the east side of Manhattan, whether I lived there or I'd be working there. I worked right by Grand Central. So I guess you're all over Manhattan?
My office is in Midtown. We have a small little office in Midtown, but I've done projects in, you know, upper Manhattan, lower Manhattan, Brooklyn. So we jump around.
Okay. So I was looking at your website and these are just colossal projects that are just multi-million or more dollars, and it's kind of intimidating to see that being someone that's maybe not quite at that scale. So how did you get to that level? And why don't you start back with your background and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. You know, I was fortunate at a young age to be put on a construction project, multi-story construction project on the waterfront of New Jersey. And at 26 years old, I was a superintendent on 956 residential units. And that really taught me how to build skyscrapers. And from there, you know, it led to a career in New York City where I built a few for other owners and developers. And then in 2008, I developed 240 Park Avenue, which was my first. And then from there, we had some challenges when Lehman crashed. But, you know, I started out really with the background in construction, and then it led to real estate, just, you know, dreaming about how can I do this?
Okay. Yeah. I remember you were, I was stalking you on LinkedIn and I noticed that you were, doing engineering before. Civil engineering was kind of your background in college. And you started that way, right?
Yes. I was a civil engineer. I created the 6-year plan in college. You know, I played football and drank a lot of beer, unfortunately. So I didn't pick up engineering right away. And, you know, after I received my engineering degree, I had already gotten started in construction and was making decent money. So I never really did engineering for more than a year, you know, and gained enough experience just to get my professional engineering license. And that opened up all kinds of doors in real estate development for me.
Okay, good. So did you ever start with single family houses or anything like that, or was it just straight to skyscrapers?
You know, the funny thing is I went, my first project was building skyscrapers, yes. And then my first project where I was on my own was a $17 million assisted living. And then I did it in reverse. So I built skyscrapers first, and then I ultimately went down. I call it, you know, descending upon, you know, the ascension path and taking the top down thinking and then applying it, you know, down to the point where 1 year when I was a partner in a company called Flipping USA, we did 137 residential deals using the modern wealth building formula. So it was fascinating to prove the theories and the systems that we were using on skyscrapers. You know, when you went into, you know, smaller commercial or the residential, you know, you stood out, you know, like a rock star because you were different, you know. And that's what I really found, you know, that the modern wealth building formula applies for any type of real estate. And, you know, I'm just like you, I put my pants on one leg at a time. You know, I started and was just fortunate to get some really good mentors that showed me how to build these super huge $100 million projects. And in New York City, you actually have to have a license to supervise those. So at a young age, at like 26 years old, I was fortunate to go through a training program and become a licensed site safety manager, which, you know, now superintendents are licensed. Back in the day, you know, anybody could run a project of that magnitude, but, you know, it's pretty intense.
Okay. Yeah. Was it kind of like an apprenticeship?
It actually was. It was an on-site apprenticeship where they trained you to manage the safety on, you know, large structures. And back in the day, the supervisor could also be the site safety manager. Now, you know, projects are, you know, so active with so many people, site safety managers is a separate position. But
okay. But you said it a couple of times as well, the modern wealth building formula.
Yeah, the modern wealth building formula is the book that we wrote that came out in 2019. And okay. Jack Canfield put his name on the front cover and Dolph DeRoos wrote the foreword. So this is how to master real estate investing. And, you know, it's worked for me. So, you know, I'm here, I'm, you know, all about contribution and paying it forward and, you know, getting it out there and letting people know that, you know, even though I built skyscrapers and it's intimidating, you know, what I've learned and the systems that I use apply for any type of real estate. So I want that, you know, starter who's, you know, wants to accelerate into residential real estate investing, you know, to take these things to heart and not get intimidated by it.
Okay. And on your website, there is a few different programs. So how does that tie in with the book? And do you like provide one-on-one coaching or what are you doing there?
Yeah. We really focus on real estate. I'll give you, you know, a little gamut on what's going on. We're developing a large turkey farm. It's a famous Larson's turkey farm in New Jersey. We're doing a mixed use development. It has restaurants. It has a CVS. It has affordable housing, market rate, commercial office. We also have another development where we're doing self-storage and a lot of residential. So our primary focus is with global real estate strategies and the projects we're working on. And we want to teach people on how that applies. Sometimes, you know, people are like, you know, commercial real estate's a little intimidating or development. And, you know, what I really tell people is that my system is all about finding real estate, funding real estate, and facilitating real estate. And the modern wealth building formula applies with that type of system. And it really shows you how to get started and how I built a $17 million project using other people's experience and other people's money and how that applies to residential on, you know, the 137 deals we did using other people's money, giving them rates of return of, you know, 20% and our rates of return exceeding sometimes 200%. So it was a really interesting phenomena that we created. And, you know, I mentioned to you before a little bit about the top-down thinking. You know, the modern wealth building formula is a blanket, is what I consider it, that applies to wholesaling, fixing and flipping, commercial, skyscrapers, land development. And then we have an ascension path that we're working on that we do deliver through a coaching program. But our foundation is really pertaining to a program that's going to come out later on in 2021, which is going to be Real Estate Mastery University in a Box. And it's the foundation of theory and practical education where you could really launch on a catapult into real estate. And then the next step in the ascension path we have is a financial freedom protocol, which is how to start and accelerate your residential real estate investing. And then we get into, you know, things like micro development, which is our system related to fixing and flipping. And then, you know, we do some one-on-one coaching and group coaching. So we're flexible and, you know, we consider ourselves like a tailored suit or a tailored dress, where if someone wants to get started, the formula is adaptable, almost like a chameleon, where it applies to any situation in any circumstance.
Okay. But it sounds like it's primarily focused on single family houses for this people going through the program and like how to do those, or I know you say it's going to be applied to any type of real estate, but.
Yeah. Well, the Modern Wealth Building Formula shows how I built a $17 million project, large commercial project. And what I tried to do was I didn't want to pigeonhole it or limit it to the people it would value. So even though the teaching is at a very high level related to, you know, skyscrapers and commercial, what I've done is bridged a gap so it applies to people in residential real estate so that they get the value of the Modern Wealth Building Formula on how, you know, essentially we bought, you know, 137 deals using other people's money.
Okay. Got it. But it wasn't like a subdivision with 137 property houses in it.
This is 137 transactions. What we used to do is we would scrape, you know, we used to get most of our properties we'd buy from the auctions in New Jersey. They used to have auctions in all the counties. So we created a software where we would scrape, you know, the foreclosure sites. They would then evaluate them against, you know, the Zillows and the valuation sites. It would highlight the properties that were 30% below market value. We then had a team of field reconnaissance that would go to the sites working alongside property analytic managers, where they would analyze and then we would prepare for bids as we would go into the auction. And we would do at least 7 auctions a week. And that was one source of deals. And, we set this operation up and then we expanded into fixing and flipping, land development, and all kinds of things just to really test out the Modern Wealth Building Formula to make sure that it worked, you know?
Okay. Yeah. I'm actually focusing on lands right now, primarily flipping lands, but I think developing land is always something I'm interested in learning more about. Could you go into that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. You know, and that's interesting that you lean into that because, you know, flipping land, there's one other option that you may want to consider, which we do a lot of times is go through the entitlement process. But, flipping land is, you know, very similar to just flipping a house. I mean, you're assigning a contract. I think where you may want to consider, or capturing some money on the table that's given to the guy that's buying it from you that goes through the approvals. One of the things we do is we show people how to structure to buy these deals contingent upon approval in some cases. And if you do due diligence and you find out what the development rights are on that. And within a short period of time, if you go through the entitlement process, you know, you could increase the land tenfold. There's a project we're working on now where we purchased at $4.5 million that once we have the entitlement rights, it's going to be worth close to, you know, $12.5 million. And that's going to be done in about a 2-year period. And then you have the option at that point to either sell, like we actually have a residential offer for almost $8 million, which will take out the investors. And then we sit on the storage facility and we can develop that ourselves or also sell that pad. So, you know, I like what you're getting into because it opens up a whole, you know, plethora of opportunities for you to look at and options around the land. And it's not labor intensive to bring a project through entitlement once you establish what I call as a dream team of design professionals that run that process for you.
Okay. So what does that mean what is the entitlement process? Like, are you changing the zoning on land or doing something else?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah. So with land, the magic buzzword, I guess you would say, is what's the highest and best use? So when you look at a piece of land, a lot of times land is already zoned, you know, to build a certain type of property. So if you had a piece of land that was zoned commercial and you envisioned, you know, a self-conscious, environmentally conscious development, you know, you would go through due diligence and find out from the professionals, hey, what's the odds of getting this project approved? Because I really think it's going to bring value to the neighborhood. So in the case where a property that you're buying has a different zoning, the entitlement process could be you going through and changing the zoning. Another process in the entitlement, you know, is where you submit what you want to do for that plan and they see if it fits within the current zoning. Sometimes it may entail a variance. So if that lot is zoned, say residential with, you know, 2-acre lots and you want to create, you know, less homes and maybe 5-acre lots, you would have to go in and get the entitlement to build larger lots. So these are two examples of the entitlement process. And it's really just, you know, going to the, you know, the local authorities and working with them to make a win-win situation for that piece of land. And in some cases, you know, towns are very stringent and, you know, the zoning is the zoning and they won't, you know, make the changes. And that's what I mentioned to you earlier in these cases where you're going into entitlement plays. A lot of times owners will be asking you for a price. You'll be going, there's no way I'm going to pay that price. But if you give them the price and you make a deal that you could buy a contingent upon approval, where you go out and get your approval, it's a win-win situation for both of you because they're going to get the price they want. You have the luxury of time to get the entitlement. And when you get that entitlement, you close, you give them what he wants. And now you have a project that you can either sell those approvals or create another syndication and raise money and just develop that and start paying yourself a fee during that process, which was one of the things that enabled me to get into business. Because when I started, I didn't have a lot of equity. And I knew about development fees and I figured, wow, $10 million project, 5% development fee, that's $500,000. That's where my thinking was. You know, it was a little narrow-minded back then, but that's how I had to get started, you know?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I'm just thinking that if I was to buy some land, I would probably need to partner with a developer and understand what they are looking for and what they want to do. Like, maybe just correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think they would tell me their criteria in terms of where they're looking to buy and they want to build like 100 homes in this area across X number of acres. And otherwise, I wouldn't really have a plan to present to the county officials. Is that correct?
Yes.
Or how else would you have a plan as just an investor, you know?
Yeah. So in the case where you took control of a site, right? Is that the example you want me to give where how you would come up with the conceptual plan?
Yeah, because like on a super basic level, I bought some land in North Carolina, for example, and there's two different ways to get a PERC test to make sure you can install a septic system. One of them is to apply through the county and have them perform the PERC test. But to do that, you have to actually like stake off where you're going to build your house and show them plans. And I'm like, I have no idea where my buyer is going to build a house. My buyer may not even build a house. I'm not going to do that. And so I do the second option, which is hire a third party just to test the soil.
Yes.
So I'm just looking at this other example where it's like, I know maybe I can go through some entitlement process, but I have no idea what the plan is going to be. So.
So in that case, and that makes a lot of sense. And you made the right move is, you know, we're doing a couple sites where we actually have to install on-site treatment plants. So we're doing a lot of subsurface investigation and you know, you can't allow townships or utilities to control you, but sometimes they do. We're doing one project where we actually have to do a water main extension. And they basically just tell you, well, that's going to cost $1 million and you really can't say anything, you know, if you want water to your site, you know. Now in your case, you know, I mentioned dream team and a dream team consists of, you know, an architect and, you know, an engineer, civil engineer, mechanical engineer. So in a lot of cases, a local civil engineer who understands the existing zoning or what your variance, they'll be the one that would sit down and come up with some conceptual plans. If, you know, you were doing a subdivision, you know, you start laying out some roads, maybe there's cul-de-sacs, you know, what lot sizes are you looking at? You know, we're looking at a property in Catskills right now where, you know, it's a couple hundred acres, but there's a segment right on the road where, you know, we're analyzing, you know, whether we can do a small community there. It's next to a ski resort. And we're literally just like hand sketching using tissue paper. And, you know, and that's where it starts. You know, it's a vision in your head, and, you know, and you just, you try to paper it. And one of the things that it brings to mind is, you know, when you build a skyscraper in some of these larger projects, you go through this process of what I call, you know, building it on paper. And you go, you know, just like the entitlement process where you come up conceptually, you know, a lot of times before we put a shovel in the ground on these skyscrapers, you know, we know every single detail, like, you know, who's doing the concrete foundation and who has the superstructure. And we've already released the exterior walls because there's such a long lead time. And, you know, it's a little bit of a science, but, you know, that's the approach that you take, and, you know, it has great results.
Okay. And I imagine the approval process, the timing on that would depend on each county, but how long on average would it take to go through that entitlement process?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great question. So, you know, we, you know, a lot of times entitlement process and, you know, in towns, you know, could take, you know, a year. In a lot of cases, you know, if you're dealing with the Department of Environmental Protection, in the case where you're dealing with septics and treatment, you know, that is a very lengthy process. They deal with creeks and water flow. And anytime you have to go through a DEP process, it's minimum of 18 months. So on my project, like when I get started, I literally figure, how am I going to carry this for 2 years? And it's lengthy. Now, some entitlements that you're not doing zoning changes and going through like bigger projects, you can get through in, you know, less than 6 months in some cases. So it definitely, as you mentioned, you know, depends on the size of the project. And, you know, that's where it always comes in, like depending on where you're working, you want to, you know, you want to hire the local favorites and who, you know, they know the ins and outs of the system, and it usually helps accelerate the process.
Okay. But I guess that right there is one of the huge ways of adding value to sell it for, like you said, multiples more. It reminds me of the pharmaceutical industry where you can like sell those rights of the FDA approval because they have to go in these different stages across these different clinical trials, and it takes forever to get through that. But I'm not sure if you're familiar with pharmaceutical stuff, but it sounds similar.
Yeah. I would think it does, you know, and in the case where they get an approval, I could imagine they could sell that off, you know, if they didn't want to go through the distribution process and make a boatload of money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So pivoting slightly, I actually previously was targeting self-storage, as some of my listeners might know, listen to earlier episodes. And it's something I'm really interested in later down the road, especially like as I get into both residential and commercial land, maybe rezoning residential. But how do you suggest I determine if a parcel's highest and best use is storage in that market? Because you did mention you're working on some storage project now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, what I've done is, you know, what I learned back when I did my first project, which was an assisted living project, which was driven by demographics. And I found in my studies that storage is driven by demographics, where you could actually calculate on how much space you'll absorb, you know, based on, you know, per capita income and population in that specific area. You know, and one of the things, you know, assisted living, you know, there's what they call a certificate of need, where the state has additional data on top of demographics, where they issue these certificates where they say, okay, in this area, you know, we have a need for 100 beds. So if you want to develop 100 beds, you know, you're essentially approved by the state. And, you know, that's similar with self-storage. When you get into, you know, when I started in considering self-storage, I brought in a self-storage expert that taught me that, you know, there's a little formula. So, you know, number one, you have to find out what your existing facilities are and, you know, how much square feet they have for a certain demographic area. And then, you know, within a certain radius, I believe it's a 5 and 10 mile radius, you look at your population and you can calculate on, you know, what will absorb. And in the case where, you know, there's a question on absorbent for your typical storages, some of the stuff that we're now looking at is we're creating these condo, you know, storage facilities where, you know, in Bedminster, it's a high net area. So, you know, we're looking at creating spaces where people can bring their fancy cars and, you know, that type of thing.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that a lot of people use like 7 square feet per capita as kind of the benchmark. And if it's below that, then it's not saturated. But if there's already like an excess of 7 square feet per capita, then it is maybe overly saturated. Is that what you use, or what is your benchmark?
You know, I'd have to look at my notes on the exact benchmark. That actually sounds a little high, actually, but that's, you know, it's give or take a few variables. But I don't have it off the top of my head. If I were to try to just give you an answer, I have so many numbers in my head. I was just analyzing this self-conscious development in Tennessee last night, and you know, we had White Plains before that. But yeah, I mean, it's there's some rule of thumbs around storage, and then you can get creative, like I said, with condoing it, which is a little bit different, you know, so you have a dual structure.
Okay. And I guess I don't fully understand. I understand I've seen like high-end luxury RV storage and other types of storage, like hangars, private jets and stuff. Are you saying that like a condo ones where they live there as a residence, and then there's also storage below it or something, or how does that work?
No, this is just more like almost, if you can envision like a high ceiling flex office where, you know, we're envisioning, you know, a mezzanine. It's more, you know, like, you know, the guy would have his fancy cars, maybe have a bar there, you know, in the facility. And, you know, it's more like a destination where they kind of hang out. You know, we have this, like, it's the site that you can almost envision. It could be a polo club in a very high end area. So, you know, that's what we're studying right now, where, you know, you would sell this condo off for, you know, a couple $100,000 and, you know, reduce your debt. And then the rental, you know, portion of it would cover and create the residual.
Okay. So you sell off a few of those units so that those buyers don't have to pay the rent anymore, but then you're retaining the majority of the other ones. So you just rent those out.
Yep. And if you self finance it, you know, it goes towards your cash flow. But in most cases, when they buy them, you know, they get their own financing, and then you know, you get your cash and lower your debt on the property.
Okay. And by self finance, you mean, what do you mean exactly?
Well, if they were to, you know, buy a $250,000 unit, right, and I would self, you know, finance it for them, they would just essentially pay me, and then I would pay my debt service.
Oh, got it. Yeah, just an owner finance, seller finance. Yeah. Self. Got it. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. You had mentioned you were working on a couple projects. I actually used to work in White Plains, so I'm familiar with that one. What is that project you're working on over there?
Yeah, so at 180 East Post Road, it's a existing commercial building that we are converting the top 2 floors into 10 luxury residential. And we, you know, just essentially put together the development budget, stabilization at snapshot at stabilization, cash flow, site logistics plan, project schedule, and a little bit of, you know, a bank package presentation so that they can get their financing set up.
Okay. That's another thing I wanted to understand is in what capacity you're involved. I know it's like it's a syndicator and everything like that, but you just said it so they can get their financing set up. Are you kind of just helping these folks, other investors?
Yeah. So Global Real Estate Strategies is a real estate advisement development firm. So, you know, we have some third party clients, like, you know, one of my clients is doing a penthouse in New York City. Another one of my clients is two dentists that they're renovating their building in White Plains. So in some cases, like I did a small pre-construction stint for these two dentists because one of the dentists was my personal student. So I kind of just, you know, wanted to help them out and not see them get hurt. They had been trying to get this project off the ground for a few months. And, you know, so I provided some services for them. So yes, in some cases, you know, I do other, you know, services for others, but, you know, my development is the Turkey Farm, Bedminster project. Some of the skyscrapers were ours and others I did for third party. But yeah, fire away with questions.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So I guess that's more of a consulting role for those people. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a process where there's less margin for error as you increase the dollar value. So it's important to have someone on the team that knows how to, you know, that knows all the right questions to ask, and, you know, consistently sticking his head in. And, you know, I used to do a lot of owner's rep work, and, you know, we've kind of veered away from that, you know, just because we have a lot of our own projects. But, you know, I love to, you know, contribute, and this is part of my contribution, human need, you know, paying it forward and giving some value to the listeners, and hopefully they could relate this and how it applies to whatever real estate they're involved in.
Okay. That actually reminds me, I forgot to ask, do you do a lot of feasibility studies, or is that just not really necessary? What do you, what's the value of that from your experience?
Yeah. No, we, you know, we do feasibility studies all the time, you know, and I, you know, I guess my definition of feasibility is really looking at every single aspect of it. You know, if there's a value add and construction aspect to it, you know, how much risk is involved? Is there, you know, we looked at a property on Saturday up in Ridgewood. It was a, I don't know, $780,000, do a 250 improvement, sell it for 1.4, but, you know, busy road. It's a county road, you know, the approval process, you know, may take a while. So, you know, we're always looking at the feasibility of, you know, what's the duration risk if there's an approval process, you know, is there a financial risk, you know, with material increases, you know, what's happening with certain markets, you know, and a lot of times if I were to give you just a summary of our feasibility study, you know, with this one project in White Plains, I'm just trying to make the client intelligent. So when he takes his next step with the bank, he can say, this project's going to take about 9 months to build. And this is our, you know, our budget estimate. Of course, we have to go out and do some value engineering, and we've done a snapshot at stabilization, and the rate of return looks pretty well. So we then took the next step and analyzed the cash flow. And this is how we'll set the job up. And these are the things that I think through so that I can give a recommendation on what I believe is the feasibility and how long it'll take. So, you know, feasibility is a key, you know, and then, you know, across the board, you want to do market comparisons and, you know, look at what the, you know, the benefits are. So yes, to answer your question.
Okay. And how much would it cost if I wanted to, like, hire your company to do some of that for me? What's your compensation structure?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it really comes down to, you know, making it work for the client, you know? So like, for example, if you needed my service where I was going to get involved in a project, you know, I try to just come up with a reasonable fee versus where if you said, hey, Ken, I just got a project in New York City. Can you go in to New York this morning and check this site out? You know, for 4 hours, I would probably charge like $1,200 or something if I had to drive into the city, you know, on a monthly rate. You know, it could vary anywhere from, on my White Plains project on pre-construction, I think I was charging $7,500. It was originally a $10,000 fee, but the dentist threw in some Invisalign braces. We made a deal, you know, I wanted to help them. They told me, you know, smile. I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, but yeah, I'm there to help. So, but I've also charged fees as high as $25,000 a month on, you know, a $15 million penthouse in New York City. So it really depends on the scope of work and how many hours, like if I'm going to, you know, spend, you know, every week going to New York, then it'll, you know, be a little bit more expensive, but I really try to make it work. And what I pride myself in is, you know, 99% of the time when I get into a project, I bring value. And then when the buyout occurs, you know, I buy down usually 5 to 10%. So that pays for me. you know, and that's the key. So, you know, I bring that service to the table and then show you how to pay for me.
Okay. When you say buy down, you're just paying them for some of that equity, huh? Like five or,
yeah, like 10%. For example, on a development project or a big project that someone's doing, you know, when I buy, when I use different terminology, sorry, when I procure the trades or if I buy out the certain subcontractor trades, you know, I normally have the ability to get the price lowered anywhere from 5 to 10% when I start to purchase materials and labor and all of those types of facets.
Okay. So does that margin, does that savings go in your pocket or is it go to your client and you're just...
No, that all goes directly to the client.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, one of the things, you know, if you were to say, hey, Ken, you know, you're charging me a fee, you know, based on a certain percentage of the cost, you know, I always tell them, well, you know, that's true if we make that type of arrangement. However, let's do a shared cost savings where, you know, I have an incentive to drive the price down. That's one option. Most of the time, I don't even bring it up, you know, if the trust factor is there. But some owners have said, well, you're getting paid per fee. You're going to drive the price up. I'm like, no, I'm going to show you how to buy the price down so we beat the budget, not use the contingency, and then it pays for my fee. But sometimes they go, okay, give me the incentive. And we set up what's called as a shared savings plan, where a lot of times for every dollar I save, I get a quarter.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that seems like a good way to align incentives.
Yeah.
So are you primarily working on deals in the tri-state area, like for this consulting arrangement? Does it need to be there where you can like physically go see it? Or if I had a deal in Texas, could you help me with that, for example?
Yeah, no, I travel all over. I'm doing some consulting in Miami. I have a project up in Connecticut, which I can drive to, but no, I've done stuff, you know, all around, and, you know, it just really depends on what the opportunity is. And, you know, a lot of times when I get into the consulting, I love where it can lead into some type of participation in the project. So I bring true value and understand the outcome, but, you know, I'm flexible and, you know, whatever we can do to help. Sure.
Okay, great. And, in terms of your focus, is it pretty good 50-50 blend between the consulting and doing your own projects? Or I guess the consulting could develop into one of a partnership into the project. So are you still like actively looking?
Yeah, no, you know, honestly, you know, I'm probably 85% on my developments and I'd say 15% between consulting / coaching. So I, you know, I have, I think right now three coaching clients and that one consulting, which I'm actually ending that consulting assignment. I just submitted a major engineering package for approval on our Larson's Turkey Farm. And, you know, we just signed a new lease with CVS. So we want to break ground in August. So we're going to be very laser focused over the next 3 months to get the approvals.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely helpful to understand. That's interesting. I know on your website, you also mentioned that, I guess a different way to invest in real estate is with private funding. Could you go into that? Is that like originating debt on a deal and just doing some private lending?
Yeah. What I was referring in context relative to that is how I've used private lenders to, you know, essentially buy deals and, you know, in many cases, you know, give them continuous opportunities investing in the real estate. You know, and what happens is once, you know, you attract private investors, I've found that upon success, you know, they're going to want to stay with you. And, you know, I formed partnerships with these private investors. When I first started, I had 10 of them, and that led into, you know, multiple investors. And then I moved into more family office so that you're not dealing with as many people. But private investors, you know, what I found in getting started, you know, are, you know, a vehicle that eliminates a lot of friction, you know, when you're trying to bridge a gap, getting started, working with institutional financing. And, you know, that was the contents that I was talking about. And that all, you know, helped me, you know, helped me when I was getting started and I didn't have the equity. You know, so, you know, I bring in investors to provide the equity, I would facilitate the deals, and then I would, you know, charge fees.
Okay, got it. So I imagine it starts with friends and family first, or how would you recommend the best way going about building out your network of private money lenders?
Yeah, it really starts out with presentation. So one of the things that I teach in the Modern Wealth Building Formula is how to create your hot sheets, your decks, your investment memorandums, and you know that presentation is really going to take you to the next level.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've had a coach that also showed similar things. She had like a binder and she'll schedule like a coffee meeting and show exactly the deals she's done. And, or even if you don't have deals, like the ones that you're analyzing and considering doing, and then how the entire, your business is set up and all that. So just to make them feel comfortable and be more transparent, which seems to be the key in just building that trust.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I think we've covered a lot here, and it's I don't want to keep you too late in the day here. So is there anything else that you feel like listeners should know that we might have missed?
Yeah, I just want people to know that, you know, I'm here to help everybody out. You know, if you want some guidance, you know, the best way to get in touch with me is just go to my website. You know, there's a button, click on Discover How. I give 45-minute free strategy sessions. That's my way. I do about 5 a week. You know, there's a line, but if you get in line, you know, in 45 minutes, I can help you create some value in what you're doing. And, you know, my book's available for free. You know, feel free to take a look at that and just, you know, pay it forward. And, you know, giving is receiving. You know, whatever I could do to help you out, reach out and let's make it happen.
All right, perfect. Yeah, I'll be sure to put your website in the show notes so people can easily access that. But I fully agree. Giving is reciprocal, you know, it's like breathing. So yes. Definitely valuable. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time. This has been really interesting. And yeah, I hope that everyone's gained something from it.
Yes, absolutely, Mason. I appreciate it. It's been my pleasure.
Great. All right, that's another episode of Scalable Real Estate Investing. Thank you for tuning in. Please be sure to leave a review and subscribe on whatever channel you're using to listen or watch these episodes. And also be sure to go to scalablerealestateinvesting.com, scroll to the bottom, and fill out the form to sign up for our email. And you could also reach me directly at mason@scalablerealestateinvesting.com. That's mason@scalablerealestateinvesting.com. If you'd like to get in touch with me to either partner on deals or even be considered to do your own episode on this podcast. Thanks again, and have a great day.